Now it's time for The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Rachel. I am going to be joined later in the hour tonight, making his debut here on the show, by Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh,
do
wow.
I have to explain who that is, Rachel? Because he's kind of a movie thing, and he's not a news person. And he's going to be joined, actually, by Aaron Sorkin, who might have, you know, written some words for Sacha to say tonight. Not that he needs any help. And I'm not going to tell you why they're both here, okay? Because it's actually kind of a movie thing that crosses over into our news. But, you know, that's what's coming up.
You've got Sacha Baron Cohen and Aaron Sorkin?
Yeah, and in my case, Aaron's the easier get, you know, because he's a friend of mine and I've worked with him and he's been on the show before. But Sacha Baron Cohen, yeah, I'm wicked excited about that.
Wow, that's incredible. I'm going to go now because I want to watch your show.
You have a reason to watch this time. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Well, we have a breaking news report, which we will get to in a moment, from Politico tonight, reporting that the first Trump aide, the first Trump appointee, has been arrested in connection with the invasion of the Capitol. He was a former aide in Mike Pompeo's State Department. His name is Federico Klein, a former Marine. He was arrested tonight for his participation in the attack on the Capitol. We're going to get to that, the details of that, in just a moment. And a new study shows that Black Lives Matter protests worked. Killings by police declined after Black Lives Matter protests. The Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964 after civil rights protests and would not have been passed without those protests. The Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 because of civil rights protests and would not have been passed without those protests. Protests can work. Anti-war protesters did something that had never been done before when they stopped the Vietnam War by slowly changing the minds of members of Congress who then shut down congressional support for the Vietnam War. Anti-war protesters had never stopped a war before. Abbie Hoffman was one of the leaders of the anti-war protesters at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The protesters didn't win in 1968, but they finally won when the last American soldier left Vietnam in 1973. President Nixon and his generals were forced to end that war years before they would have, thanks to millions of American anti-war protesters. The protesters were right and the president was wrong and the generals were wrong. Abbie Hoffman and the anti-war protesters saved lives by forcing the end of that war. But Abbie Hoffman and other leaders of the anti-war movement were put on trial for what they did in 1968 at the Democratic Convention. Reports from the courtroom dominated the news for months in what the news media then called the trial of the Chicago Seven, which is now the title of the powerful new film written and directed by Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin with Sacha Baron Cohen in a mesmerizing performance as Abbie Hoffman. Sacha Baron Cohen and Aaron Sorkin will join us later in this hour. We now have peaceful relations with Vietnam. There are no more American soldiers in Vietnam, but there are American soldiers in Washington, D.C. tonight. National Guard troops are guarding the Capitol and the government from a threatened attack by the most deranged people who voted for Donald Trump. Every single person who attacked the Capitol on January 6th was a supporter of Donald Trump. And now every threat being picked up about possible new attacks on the Capitol are by supporters of Donald Trump. Now, most Trump voters know that the people who attacked the Capitol and want to attack the Capitol again are insane and criminals. 74 million people voted for Donald Trump, and just about 74 million of those people did not once even consider lifting a finger or their voice to protest Donald Trump's loss to Joe Biden. 74 million Trump voters went about their business disappointed in the outcome of the election, knowing that they'd get a chance to vote for president again in 4 years, and that was good enough for them. But a few thousand completely deranged people who desperately need help followed what they believed were Donald Trump's orders to attack the Capitol. And Donald Trump has once again proved that he wanted them to attack the Capitol because he had a chance to tell them not to attack the Capitol again today. And he refused to do that. When threats against the Capitol focusing on today, March 4th, emerged, Donald Trump could have easily released a public statement saying, in effect, don't attack the Capitol. One Republican member of Congress, a former chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, said this yesterday.
Yeah, I think President Trump has a responsibility to tell them to stand down. This threat is credible and it's real.
We all know what happens when you put the word Trump and responsibility in the same sentence. Nothing. Nothing happens when you ask Donald Trump to be responsible, and nothing happened at the Capitol today, possibly because the evidence of another plot to attack the Capitol was exposed, and even more National Guard troops were sent to the Capitol and to the congressional office buildings today. Republican Senator Ron Johnson didn't know that nothing was going to happen at the Capitol today. He didn't know that the Senate wasn't going to be attacked again? Or did he? Even though the Capitol was under a threat today, Ron Johnson decided to use a power that every senator has and none of them use to order Senate clerks to read every page of the 628-page Biden COVID relief bill. With a credible threat against the Capitol today, Ron Johnson decided to force Senate clerks to remain on the Senate floor for hours on end, reading 628 pages. Which is what they are doing right now. There they are. They are on page 390 right now. Ron Johnson's stunt and his cruelty to those Senate clerks who you see on your screen will not delay by even a day the delivery of $1,400 Biden COVID relief checks, along with $3,000 child tax credits. Senate Democrats unified today when they cast their first vote on the bill, which was a simple motion to begin to debate the COVID relief bill. All 50 senators were joined by Vice President Kamala Harris in a 51-50 vote to simply proceed to consideration of the bill. 50 Republicans voted against even talking about the COVID relief bill. Joining us now, Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio. He is the chair of the House Appropriations Legislative Branch Subcommittee, which oversees the Capitol Police. Congressman Ryan, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and I'm very glad that we're welcoming you on a night that was an uneventful day at the Capitol today.
Yeah, thank God, Lawrence. Appreciate that, but it's a sign of the times, and we're continuing to have to deal with this threat, and fortunately nothing happened, and we can continue the nation's business.
I want to get your reaction to this new reporting by Politico. It's just about a half hour old at this point from Politico. They report the FBI on Thursday arrested Federico Klein, a former State Department aide, on charges related to the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, making him the first known instance of an appointee of President Donald Trump facing criminal prosecution in connection with the attempt to block Congress from certifying President Joe Biden's victory. It will be fascinating, Congressman, to hear what his defense is in court. Is he going to claim the president ordered me to do it?
Well, I'm sure he will. But again, this is a blockbuster. I mean, there's no question about it. But unfortunately, in this day and age, I don't think anybody's really surprised that people who worked for Donald Trump would be involved in something like that. They have been complicit for the last 4 years, going back to Charlottesville and all of these other instances where people who were around him, close to him, appointed by him, supporters of him, never said a word. And so it's not really surprising, unfortunately, that somebody that was appointed by him would have been there on January 6th or aiding and abetting. It'll be interesting to see what his role exactly was.
Well, it also becomes interesting, for example, how he got that job, because as you and I know, that's a political appointee job. Is he someone who's a favorite of Mike Pompeo's, or, there's going to be a very interesting report on how this person ended up in the Trump administration before then ending up in the invasion of the Capitol.
Yeah, you got to be very close. I mean, a lot of us as Democrats now are going through the appointment process. Or trying to help people get into the administration, you've got to have some pull. And so this person probably did, and we'll see who their connections were. I mean, it's hard to tell with this group where he came from, but we're going to find out. And that's what I love. Nobody's above the law here, Lawrence. This is what is really the bright spot of this entire thing, is to watch the FBI continue to do their work. Watch the U.S. Attorney's Office continue to do their work, including possibly members of Congress who are not good. No one's going to look the other way for them as well. And I think that's the sign that the rule of law is continuing to take hold and justice is continuing to take hold. It was in doubt there for a while, but I think we're getting back on track.
There's in 2022, there is an open Senate seat in Ohio. There'll be a retiring Republican senator. Are you considering running for that seat? And why would you want to do it when you watch the madness that we're looking at on the Senate floor tonight?
You sound like my wife, Lawrence. I mean, it's, you know, yeah, I'm very interested in it. We're looking at it very, very closely. Because it's an opportunity to, you know, do good things to try to move the ball down the field. I represent a working class district that has been, in many instances, left behind from globalization, automation. And there are opportunities to plug these communities and these families into the new economy. But you need people on the Senate floor that aren't acting like Ron Johnson, but are acting more like Sherrod Brown, you know, acting more like somebody who cares about the workers. And that's, you know, that's a powerful place to be. You work there for a long time and you can make a big difference. And to have somebody from, you know, Niles, Ohio on the Senate floor, yeah, making a difference, it's intriguing to us. So we're looking very, very closely at it. And it's exciting for us in Ohio, too, to have an opportunity. We haven't, Democrats haven't held this seat for decades, and we may have a good shot at picking it up. So we're super excited about that.
What do you hear from your constituents about this Biden COVID relief bill and what they want from that bill?
Well, they, you know, what don't they want? I mean, you talk to teachers, they need some help. You talk to principals, superintendents, they need help. You know, your phone blows up because people aren't getting their unemployment checks. So there's a big extension there. The waitresses and waiters that are working more hours or as many hours as they used to work and making half as much as they used to make, they need that $1,400 check. The utilities, the help with their rent and rent relief. I mean, people are hanging on by a string, which is why it's so maddening when Ron Johnson is there doing what he's doing to just drag this out. It may not be long, but it's longer than it needs to be. And they need help across the board, Lawrence. And I just think that this is so straightforward for the economy, but also this is a moral issue. I mean, make no mistake about it. This package is a moral package that is supporting people who need help. And this garbage that somehow the Republicans are going to be the class or the party of the working class, when in fact this entire bill is a shot right for the working class, and they're all voting against it and they're all dragging their feet on it. So we got to call BS on that. But let's get it out the door and start helping people.
Congressman Tim Ryan, thank you very much for starting us off tonight.
Thanks, Lawrence. You got a good show ahead, I see.
Thank you very much. And coming up, how do you solve a problem like the filibuster? I probably should have sung that lyric. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin has promised he wants to preserve the filibuster rule. But what if there's a way for Senator Manchin to keep his promise, but to enforce the rule differently so that Democrats will actually have a real chance of passing the Biden agenda in the Senate? Our next guest has solved that puzzle. It should be painfully obvious to everyone by now that nothing in the Biden legislative agenda that requires 60 votes in the Senate is going to pass. Technically, the problem is not the filibuster, which is a dramatic show on the Senate floor where one senator holds the floor nonstop until that senator just can't speak another word. We see real filibusters on the Senate floor less than once a decade now. Most senators never even think of mounting a real filibuster. A much lazier practice has taken its place, and instead of one heroic or misguided senator blocking the progress on the Senate floor, the cloture rule requires 60 votes for the Senate to close debate and move forward. In today's Senate, that means the Democrats would need 10 Republicans to join them to vote for cloture so that the Senate could then vote on real legislation. 10 Republicans will never cast that vote. Never. Republicans don't even have to show up for cloture votes now because it's impossible for the Democrats to get 260. That is the rule that West Virginia's Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, almost alone among Democrats, wants to preserve. Joe Manchin has promised his West Virginia voters that he will preserve that rule, commonly referred to as the filibuster rule. And so, as not to confuse anyone this evening, I will surrender to that common usage and call it the filibuster rule. Some House Democrats are now complaining about the filibuster rule and about Joe Manchin more than they have ever complained about anything in the Senate, because the rule has never been more obviously absurd and profoundly anti-democratic, as in anti-democracy. You can try to crush Joe Manchin and make him break his promise to his voters in a state that Donald Trump, that voted for Donald Trump twice, or you can try pushing Joe Manchin toward your view, but pushing Joe Manchin toward a Democratic view of Senate rules, you might just push him all the way out of the Democratic Party and send him walking across the aisle to join the Republicans. And if that happens, Mitch McConnell instantly becomes the majority leader of the United States Senate. And that did happen the last time we had a 50-50 Senate. And luckily for the Democrats, it was a Republican who walked across the aisle under too much pressure to conform to his party. And that gave the Democrats control of the Senate. Such is life in a 50-50 Senate. Our next guest has been listening to Joe Manchin and has come up with a way for Joe Manchin to keep his promise about the filibuster rules, but shift the burden of how the rules are enforced in a way that would allow the Democrats much more opportunity to maneuver and proceed on the Senate floor. It is an elegant solution, and I would feel embarrassed for not having thought of it myself were it not for the fact that Norm Ornstein has been studying the workings of the United States Senate much longer than I have and knows much more about it than I do. Joining us now is Norm Ornstein, congressional historian and scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His new article in the Washington Post is entitled "Democrats Can Kill the Cannot Kill the Filibuster, But They Can Gut It." Norm, let's get to your two biggest ideas. Let's start with the present and voting way of determining the threshold here and how that actually used to be the rule.
So, Lawrence, the last time the filibuster was changed for legislation in a fundamental way in 1975, the lore is that they lowered the threshold from 2/3 to 3/5. But it didn't work that way. It was before this 2/3 of those present and voting, and now it's 3/5 of the entire Senate. As you said, the burden now is on the majority. Now, if you have a present and voting standard and you go around the clock, if the minority doesn't show up, if, say, 20 of their members don't show up, then under the 3/5 standard, you only need 48 senators to invoke that cloture, stop the debate, and move to a vote. But if it's an absolute standard, the way it is now, if you decided to go around the clock, the minority doesn't have to show up at all. A couple of members can be there. One to deny the absence of a quorum, to note the absence of a quorum, or to keep from getting some kind of unanimous consent agreement. It's the majority that has to show up. So if you move this back to a present and voting standard, make it 3/5 of those present and voting, then Democrats can shine a spotlight on an important issue like H.R. 1, democracy reform. Make them go round the clock for 2 weeks. Make the 87-year-olds like Chuck Grassley and Dick Shelby and Jim Inhofe have to sleep on those lumpy cots all night long. And if they don't show up, then you've got the opportunity to break that filibuster.
Yeah, and this, for Joe Manchin, this takes you back to an even earlier precedent. So you are still listening to what Joe Manchin says he wants and trying to work within that and say, okay, well, here's a Senate precedent that preexists the one they're using now. Let's go to your other idea, which is a new idea, which is switching the burden. Now it requires 60 votes to proceed. And you're saying, what if we switch that to 40 votes in order to basically continue debating the bill?
And I'd like to even push the envelope a little bit, make it 45 votes. But the idea here is the burden is supposed to be on the minority. What Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have talked about, both of them, is this idea that you need to give the minority some skin in the game. The old filibuster, the one that they've lionized, it was all about a minority feeling so intensely about an issue that they would take on a great burden and go to great lengths. Now they don't even have to lift a little finger. put the burden back on them. Every vote, the cloture comes if they can't muster the 40 or 41 or 45. They've got to be there constantly. They all have to be around. And if you make them debate on the floor while all of this is going on, you add to that burden. You're not eliminating the rule. You're restoring what it was supposed to be, what they have lionized. It's not perfect. Nothing is. But it gives us a fighting chance of getting things like democracy reform, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and some other things that are very important to us. And the fact is, as you said earlier, we're not going to eliminate the rule. We are not going to be able to do it with 50 senators, with a couple who are dug in against it. We have to find a different way to operate.
Well, you know, I'm not opposed to continuing lobbying Senator Manchin, but what you're saying is, okay, if that doesn't work, don't give up. There's some other ways that you can soften what we currently have. And I know you've talked to Al Franken about this. He's with this idea. He told me what he was telling you about it, which is he used to sit on the Senate floor during these cloture situations and say to Republicans, well, geez, you know, I have to be here this weekend. And they would say, well, we don't. We're leaving because they don't have to be there to sustain their blocking maneuver. And they get to go off on the weekend and the Democrats are sitting there trying to muster 60 votes, which they simply can't muster.
And of course, the way it works now, you can filibuster everything. Little bills, big bills, take up a lot of time on the floor because it costs you nothing. If we change the burden back to the minority, they're only going to do it in a handful of cases. And when they do, we're going to get a public spotlight shined on them that's going to make it very different. Imagine if, for example, you brought up the Voting Rights Act that would now apply to everybody, not just those five states, to satisfy the Supreme Court. And you made them go round the clock explaining why they're against voting rights when most of them voted for the original Voting Rights Act. You can make a difference this way. And we have a chance, I think, to get all of those senators and get the 50 to make a difference. If we don't, then we're not going to get that legislation. You push Joe Manchin, and you're going to end up with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Norm Ornstein, thank you very much for your thinking on this. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Lawrence.
Thank you. And as Senate clerks continue to read the COVID relief bill, we'll be joined by two members of the House, Rosa DeLauro and Richie Torres, to focus on an important provision in that bill. That's next. Senate clerks are on page 414 of the reading of the COVID relief bill. There are so many important provisions in this 628-page bill that is being read on the Senate floor right now that most of them don't even get mentioned in many of the news summaries that tend to focus on only three or four prominent provisions. In our What's in the Bill segments, we will be studying one provision at a time. Tonight, the Senate clerks read this provision on page 362, the child tax credit. A tax credit is a check. It is real money, just like the now famous $1,400 checks that everyone knows people are going to be receiving from this bill. The bill will increase the child tax credit 50%. It will go from $2,000 to $3,000 per child with an extra $600 added for every child under 6 years old. That's $3,600 in real money if you have a five-year-old child at home. That provision of the bill will lift more than 4 million children out of poverty. Joining us now is Democratic Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. She is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee and has been advocating the child tax credit since 2003. Also joining us, Democratic Congressman Richie Torres. He is a freshman who campaigned on expanding the child tax credit. Chairwoman DeLauro, let me begin with you. You have been a crusader on this. This is the most significant increase in this tax credit that we have seen.
First of all, so thanks to you, Lawrence, for having both Congressman Torres and myself on the program tonight. And we also want to tip our hat to Congresswoman Susan DelBene, who is the third author of the American Family Act, the Child Tax Credit. You know, this is a historic moment for our country. Lawrence. It really is. We are about to create a child allowance that, as you have pointed out, will lift 4 million children, one half of children in this country, out of poverty. And in my own district, in the 3rd District of Connecticut, over 50% of kids will be lifted out of poverty. And this is the scale. The scale of this is what Franklin Roosevelt did when he passed the Social Security Act, and which lifted 90% of seniors out of poverty. Now we have the ability to lift millions of children out of poverty. And it is really an extraordinary moment. And I have, you know, it's 2003 is when I introduced the First Amendment on a child tax credit. So you can imagine how this has come full circle and how excited I am to hear you talk about page 362 of the bill. and this is the moment. We're on the cusp. We are on the cusp.
Right. Well, you know, when I was working in the Senate for Senator Moynihan, he was a leader on this kind of issue in the Senate. And whenever welfare reform proposals came up, he would always say, you know, the thing that cures poverty is money. And money was the thing that the government was most reluctant to give people who needed money. And Congressman Torres, your constituents in the Bronx, it's one of the more economically disadvantaged congressional districts. This is real money to them, isn't it?
It is real money. The South Bronx is said to be the poorest congressional district in America, and there's no single policy that would do more to lift the South Bronx out of poverty than the American Family Act, which would permanently expand the child tax credit. No, the subject of poverty is no abstraction to me. It's deeply personal. I spent most of my life in poverty in the South Bronx. I was raised by a single mother. We had to raise 3 children on minimum wage, which in the 1990s was a mere $4.25. And if we had access to the child tax credit, it would have been a game changer for me and my family. So I've been on a personal mission to ensure that no child in America faces the hardship that weighed heavily on me as a child.
Congressman DeLauro, talk about what it takes to get these kinds of provisions in bills like this, including one of the reasons it's in this bill tonight is that you have been pushing it for all of these years.
Well, I have spent a lot of time and just every year in and year out, advocating, building a coalition really get it placed where it is. But I would just say the moment that we are at, Lawrence, is that we have presidential leadership. President Biden is four square for this piece of legislation. He spoke to our Democratic caucus not 2 nights ago, where he said he is committed to making this permanent. And when I had the opportunity to be in the Oval Office with my colleagues, and he was sitting under that portrait of Franklin Roosevelt, and it just clicked. And I just said, you know, with that stroke of a pen, you're able to do this the way Franklin Roosevelt lifted seniors out of poverty. But it has been Congressman Torres, Congresswoman Del Bene, and building a coalition. And, you know, my mother, who passed away 3 years ago at age 103, said, Rosa, you never give up and you never take no for an answer. So we've never given up. We don't take no for an answer. And we move on, and we are going to get the child tax credit passed. President is for it, the Congress is for it, and the pandemic makes the urgency of it all the more poignant.
Congressman Torres, the $1,400 check has been well publicized. I think people know that's coming. You know, whether or not there's going to be an increase in the minimum wage has gotten an awful lot of attention. Do your constituents know that this money is coming in the child tax credit?
There's more awareness than ever before. And for me, the most important provision of the American Rescue Plan is the child tax credit, which we need to make permanent. No permanent child tax credit would do for children what Medicare and Social Security did for senior citizens. It would end extreme poverty among the most vulnerable Americans. So it represents a historic triumph of economic and social justice, and everyone should know about it.
Mm-hmm. Chairwoman Rosa DeLauro and Congressman Richie Torres, thank you both very much for joining us tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much for having us.
Thank you. Up next, Golden Globe's best actor, Sacha Baron Cohen, will join us in his debut on The Last Word, and Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin will make a return appearance to The Last Word. That's next. We are a nation of protesters. This nation was born in protest with a birth certificate called a Declaration of Independence, written by protesters. By the end of the 1960s, two massive protest movements overlapped when civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. began adding their voices to the anti-war movement, which was led mostly by young American men who were subject to being drafted into the army and shipped off to die in Vietnam in a war the United States was on its way to losing decisively, with 55,000 Americans killed in action. The protesters called it an immoral, illegal, unwinnable war. The presidents and generals insisted we would win the Vietnam War, and they were all wrong. The protesters who said we couldn't win were all right, including Abby Hoffman, played brilliantly by Sacha Baron Cohen in Aaron Sorkin's masterful film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven.
Do you have contempt for your government?
I'll tell you, Mr. Schultz, it's nothing compared to the contempt my government has for me.
We've heard testimony from 27 witnesses under oath that say you hoped for a confrontation with the police, that your plans for the convention were designed specifically to draw the police into a confrontation.
Well, if I'd known it was going to be the first wish of mine that came true, I would have aimed a lot higher.
It's a yes or no question. When you came to Chicago, were you hoping for a confrontation with the police? I'm concerned you have to think about it.
Give me a moment, would you, friend? I've never been on trial for my thoughts before.
Joining us now, Sacha Baron Cohen, who won a Golden Globe on Sunday night for Best Actor in a very different movie and came in second for the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor for his portrayal of Abby Hoffman in The Trial of the Chicago Seven, and Aaron Sorkin, who won the Golden Globe for Best Screenplay and apparently came in second for the Golden Globe for Best Director. Thank you both for being here. And Sacha, I know that show business protocol requires that the movie star speaks first, but I beg your indulgence in this instance, with your permission, as the movie star, may I violate show business protocol and direct the first question to Aaron?
Fine, but only because this is live. Normally, my publicist would intervene, but...
No, I know. That's exactly what I'm taking advantage of. Exactly. Aaron, it's so long ago, it feels many years ago, when you first said to me that Steven Spielberg brought you an idea about the Trial of Chicago 7, and I thought, boy, that was in development for a while, and then nothing happened, and then here we are.
Yeah, it's been 15 years. It was in 2006 on a Saturday morning. Steven Spielberg asked me to come to his house. Just to be very clear, that's not common. I don't hang out with Steven Spielberg on Saturday mornings. He said he wanted to make a movie about the Chicago 7, and I said, count me in, Chicago 7, that sounds great. This is going to be a fantastic movie. Left his house, called my father, and asked him who the Chicago 7 were. I was just saying yes to doing a movie with Spielberg. And I just kept writing it and writing it and writing it. And for a whole host of reasons, it kept getting moved to next year. And now it's not going to happen at all. And finally, Donald Trump started running for president and he got elected and he had rallies and there'd be a protester. And he'd start getting nostalgic about the old days when we'd carry that guy out of here on a stretcher. I like to punch him right in the face and let's beat the crap out of him. I'll pay your legal bills. And Steven decided the time to make this film was now. And by then I directed my first film, Molly's Game. And he said that I should direct Chicago 7. So we thought the film was plenty relevant last winter when we were making it. We didn't need it to get more relevant, but it did obviously in May with the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. Protesters took to the streets all over America. And in a number of those cities, the protesters were met again by riot clubs and tear gas. And then finally on January 6th, Donald Trump stood at a microphone and did exactly what the Chicago 7 were on trial for doing.
Sasha, you lived at a greater distance from this story. Aaron was just too young to have lived through it, but there's a whole ocean between you and this story. What attracted you to this script?
Well, I'd first heard about Abbie Hoffman when I was a student in Cambridge researching the Jewish Black Alliance in the 60s and looking at Jewish left-wing students who went down south to fight for against systemic racism. Abbie was one of those. And that group of students became the epicenter of the anti-Vietnam War movement. And so, yeah, I knew about this from the age of 20. Then I also heard that Spielberg was making this movie, called him up and cheekily asked whether I could audition.
Well, that worked out. Let's listen to what Jerry Rubin said during the trial.
As I say, you know, I say in a way I want to laugh because the story is kind of exciting. I think we ought to make a movie and have Pearson be the director of the film because it's a great story, the waste, the whole thing, the diary. It's really right out of the Latin American revolutions and right out of James Bond and everything, and Pearson's quite a hero. I dig it, you know. I sat there saying, now, if this were all a dream, it'd be great.
Sasha, did you study a lot of video like that of the characters in this movie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was an intimidating character to try and portray. You're portraying somebody who's real, somebody that people know about, and that many people alive now actually knew. So I got hold of every bit of video that I could get from him. I read all his books. I managed to track down radio of some of his stand-up tours. You know, he was a huge fan of Lenny Bruce and kind of aped his comical style. So, yeah, I try to get everything I could. And obviously trying to master the accent being an Englishman was a challenge because he's born in Boston but was educated in Brandeis and Berkeley. So, it was tough. And I'm half a foot taller than him.
Yes, there's that.
I couldn't do anything about it.
Well, you had your director to fix that for you, the whole height problem. Aaron, I got a tweet sent to me before the show tonight. This is not someone I know. And he said, Sorkin is the only writer that can make me feel so patriotic that it brings tears to my eyes. And I'm Canadian. Aaron, do you think of yourself as a patriotic writer?
I do. First of all, I just want to thank whoever wrote that tweet because I always wanted. I wrote this film over and over and over again. It took a long time, but I always wanted people to feel good at the end of the movie. I just wanted people to feel taller, and I think that they do. And listen, you know, from the time we spent together on the West Wing, that I like reclaiming the idea of patriotism from the silly idea of patriotism, you know, just flag waving, that kind of nonsense. You know, the Chicago Seven, who they were seven very funny guys, but they were terribly serious guys. The Chicago Seven were called un-American, unpatriotic, anti-American, overly educated. It's still an insult that I don't understand. Lame pansies, okay? Well, they were anything but lame. They risked their lives. They risked 10 years in federal prison in order to, today it's widely accepted that the protests that they led and the thousands of others who protested with them hastened the end of this disastrous war. So I would just say, put them up next to senators who are unwilling to risk having a primary opponent. Tell me who the Patriots are.
We're going to squeeze in a break here. We'll be right back with Sasha Baron Cohen and Aaron Sorkin. During the commercial break, they can fight over who will get the last word. Here is Sasha Baron Cohen in November of 2019.
Today, around the world, demagogues appeal to our worst instincts. Conspiracy theories once confined to the fringe are going mainstream. Hate crimes are surging, as are murderous attacks on religious and ethnic minorities. All this hate and violence is being facilitated by a handful of internet companies that amount to the greatest propaganda machine in history. Zuckerberg speaks of welcoming a diversity of ideas, and last year he gave us an example. He said that he found posts denying the Holocaust deeply offensive, but he didn't think Facebook should take them down because I think there are things that different people get wrong. To quote Edward R. Murrow, one cannot accept that there are on every story two equal and logical sides to an argument. We have, unfortunately, millions of pieces of evidence for the Holocaust. It is an historical fact. And denying it is not some random opinion. Those who deny the Holocaust aim to encourage another one.
Back with us, Sacha Baron Cohen and Aaron Sorkin. Sacha, the seriousness of purpose of that is not something that people are used to. Certainly, they don't have a lot of that in your work. What you brought to that is something that strikes me as very similar to what we often hear in Aaron Sorkin's speeches about the way he wants the world to be. Did you find yourselves to have that kind of kindred spirit about these kinds of crusades?
I think we did. In fact, one of the early conversations we had was about the danger of social media and its responsibility in spreading conspiracies, hate, and lies. And actually, Aaron, if you look back, wrote a fantastic op-ed in the New York Times critiquing Mark Zuckerberg.
And Aaron, go ahead, Aaron. Your Oscar is for the social media, so I think you might have something to say about this.
Well, the speech you just showed, that's just one of the reasons I admire Sacha so much.
Thank you.
That was all I had to say about that.
Okay. I'm having a little trouble with audio right here, but Sacha, the commitment that these young people, you were all young people. I mean, I was a kid at the time of the Chicago 7 trial, so they seemed like, you know, real old guys to me. But the commitment you saw in these young people that you were portraying in the Chicago 7 seems very similar to the commitment we've seen on American streets with Black Lives Matter protests over the last year.
Definitely. When we made this, there was not that mass movement and that mass sense of communal courage. And it took immense courage to risk going out during COVID to protest against systemic racism. And actually, you look at the last 12 months, we've seen it. Incredible courage from protest movements around the world who are out there peacefully protesting dictatorships and autocratic rulers everywhere from Moscow to Myanmar. In Belarus, we had a largely led female movement where they risked extreme violence. So it really has been a year where young people in most part have gone out and actively made democracy happen or fought for democracy.
Aaron, when you were alone in the room writing the script for the Chicago 7, did you then later find yourself out there on the set as a director with Sacha, with the other actors, and discovering new things about it that you could only find by being out there as the director?
Yes, absolutely. And particularly, listen, the cast, obviously, yeah, I'm beginning to think that it's possible that the performances of the actors have something to do with the quality of the film. This cast was incredible to work with. Coming to the set in the morning, I felt like I was getting tossed the keys to a Formula One race car. And as long as I didn't put the car in the wall, these actors were going to win the race. A good tug of war that we had on the set, which was helpful for the film, was that Sacha and Jeremy Strong, Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, they understood that it was their job in the courtroom every day to demonstrate to this judge that they have no respect for this proceeding at all. and that they were going to do whatever they could in the courtroom to bother Frank Langella, basically. In the meantime, I had to make sure, because we're doing a courtroom drama, that both sides cared about whether they won or lost. So we kind of kept going back and forth on how much circus there could be in the film. But these guys had done a tremendous amount of research coming in. Look, even before Sasha got the part, he was
Aaron, I'm sorry. We're going to have to take that into our offline discussion. We are out of time. And Sasha, that's the only reason Aaron Sorkin got the last word. Sasha Baron Cohen, Aaron Sorkin, thank you both for joining us tonight.
I'm right.
Okay, Sasha did get the last word.